During the long debate over financial reform, there was one voice you didn't hear too often, Senator Chuck Schumer's. That's because over his 25 years in Washington, New York's senior senator has emerged as one of the stronger advocates for Wall Street's interests. Joining me now to discuss Senator Schumer's relationship with the financial industry is Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker and a senior analyst for CNN. His article, The Senator and the Street, appears in the August 2nd issue of the magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome Jeffrey back to our microphones.
Hi, Lenny.
Hi.
Great to be back. I think I qualify as a friend of the program.
Well, you have also been a guest host.
I wasn't sure
whether you were going to push me out of my seat.
No, never.
Has Chuck Schumer always been a voice for Wall Street in Washington?
You know, I think he really has. You know, one of the things that interested me in reporting about Chuck Schumer is that, you know, he's been a major political figure in New York State and city for so long. You sort of think you know him, but, you know, he's actually not the typical big city liberal that I think many people, particularly outside, think he is. This is a guy who's a real moderate in many respects, who's an advocate for business. And the biggest business in his town is finance. And he has really been a tremendous advocate for the interests of Wall Street firms, which was good in good times and not so good when times got bad.
Well, the financial industry is a key factor in New York's economy, both the city and the state. So I guess we shouldn't be surprised that he has supported a major employer of his constituents. It wouldn't be all that different from a senator from Illinois supporting ethanol subsidies, would it?
Absolutely not. And I think, you know, that is the root of Schumer's support for Wall Street. I mean, he, as he often says, is obsessed with preserving jobs for New Yorkers, and the financial industry is a key, probably the biggest. Maybe healthcare is a little bit ahead, but I mean it's certainly the biggest private employer as an industry in New York City, and he's fought to preserve those jobs, and who can blame him?
On the other hand, some of the things that he's done have come back to haunt him, or has he been blamed for what he did? For example, what role did he play in getting rid of some of the reporting regulations in the Sarbanes-Oxley law in 2007?
Well, see, this is where his advocacy for Wall Street becomes problematic for him politically, because certainly no one begrudges his support for a major employer. The problem is Wall Street isn't just an employer. It is a major factor in the American economy, and the financial collapse that we are still living in the aftermath of is regarded by many people as in part the result of lax regulation of Wall Street. And during the Bush term, in particular, he was an advocate of less regulation in several important areas. And I think those views have come a cropper for him.
In 2006, he wrote an amendment to bar the Securities and Exchange Commission from overseeing credit ratings agencies. That's been cited. I don't mean his particular amendment, but although what happened has been cited as one of the major factors in the economic meltdown, that Moody's and Standard & Poor's weren't doing their jobs well.
I think if you were to pinpoint sort of the nadir of Schumer's career, that sponsorship of that amendment might be it, because, you know, as you said, the rating agencies, you know, really turned into ratings for hire. They were paid by the firms they were evaluating. They evaluated a lot of these mortgage-backed securities in wildly inflated ways. That was certainly a major cause of the collapse. And so getting them out from regulation is not something I suspect that Chuck Schumer will want in his obituary.
It's been suggested that Standard & Poor's changes its name to Poor Standards.
But there you go.
But Senator Schumer is also on the Senate Finance Committee and the Banking Committee. Is that something that he was able to work out early in his time in the Senate?
Well, actually, one of the interesting subplots of Schumer's current career is that he is now the third ranking Democrat in the Senate, and that is largely due to the sponsorship of the Majority Leader, Harry Reid.
And if Harry Reid loses his seat, which has been said to be a possibility. I don't know. That election isn't going all that well for his opponent. But if he loses his seat, does that mean Chuck Schumer moves up?
Well, I certainly suggest that he has a chance to move up. And the number two Democrat is Dick Durbin of Illinois. And what makes this sort of delicious from a journalistic perspective is that the two likely successors, Dick Durbin and Chuck Schumer, are roommates in a famously disheveled townhouse on Capitol Hill.
With two other members of Congress.
With two other members
of Congress. All known to not be sharp dressers.
Not to be sharp dressers, not to be excellent housekeepers. It's Bill Delahunt, the congressman from Massachusetts, shares the downstairs with Schumer. And the other upstairs bedroom is George Miller of California, who actually owns the place.
Now, is that typical? Because don't many members of Congress simply move their families to Washington?
They do. And I think it is very much evidence of Chuck Schumer's energy and his commitment to New York that he never moved to Washington, and he flies the shuttle like most of us go up and down an escalator. I mean, he's back and forth so often, and I think it shows also his commitment to Brooklyn. I mean, this is a guy who lives in Park Slope, and he is very much a part of this community there. His two daughters played softball for local leagues before they went off to school, to college. I mean, he is very much still part of the community in Brooklyn, and I think that's evidence. And his wife, Iris Weinshall, was a major public figure in her own right. She was transportation commissioner under Mayor Giuliani and in the early part of the Bloomberg term. So, I mean, this is a guy who never gave up his New York roots.
Yeah, she's working for two Republican mayors. Isn't that – does that say anything, or is it just turn out that way?
I mean, I think it's testament, frankly, to her competence as an administrator. She is a really very well-regarded public servant in her own right. I don't think – the transportation commissioner is a job that really requires a lot of Democratic or Republican leanings. I think it's a job that most mayors just want to see done done well. And I think it is widely regarded that she was very effective. And she's now a vice chancellor at CUNY, City University of New York.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. His article, The Senator in the Street, appears in the August 2nd issue of The New Yorker. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. As I said, Senator Schumer sits on both the Senate Finance Committee and the Banking Committee. Doesn't that make it particularly unusual for him to have been so quiet during the debate over financial reform? He could have argued the other side, couldn't
he? Well, I think one of the novelties of this whole story is how often have you heard the words Chuck Schumer and quiet in the same sentence on any issue?
They used to joke that the most dangerous place in the world to be was between Chuck Schumer and a reporter with a camera.
That's actually a Bob Dole line from when he was in the House. So yes, it is unusual for him, and I think it was a conscious decision, frankly, in part due to sort of his embarrassment for being part of the being, I think, part of the problem. And to be fair to him, I don't think you can blame the whole financial crisis on Chuck Schumer. But the other thing is, you know, he wants to preserve his relationships with Wall Street, so he doesn't want to embarrass them by denouncing them. And so he voted for the bill. Let's be clear about that. He certainly voted for it. He was a supporter of the regulation, but he didn't call a lot of attention to himself.
It also maintains his liberal bona fides, doesn't it? You suggest that that his reputation as a liberal, it's helped him in certain ways, but it hasn't always been something he's earned.
That's right. And you know, it depends on how liberal you are as a voter, whether you are pleased by that or disappointed by that.
Well, but we're talking about New York.
New York, there are a lot of people in New York who are liberal, but there are also a lot of moderates. And I think one of the things that surprised me most in working on this New Yorker story was throughout Schumer's career, and this is not just a recent development, is that he has been very much a pragmatist, and he is not someone who has, for example, been agitating for national health insurance his whole career like a lot of liberals have. He is not someone who is interested in grand domestic policy innovations and big expensive projects. He's really very much an incrementalist. I read his book, which as he was honest enough to point out. Not a lot of people did read his book, but he wrote a book called Positively American. And I was struck by how modest the ideas were. I mean, even in the context of a book where you can propose pie in the sky, he proposed very narrow, limited ideas, you know, on the liberal democratic side, but not, you know, efforts to change global warming, achieve world peace. It was a much more modest agenda, and I think that's really who Schumer is.
How has he adapted to the new political reality now that that Wall Street has fallen out of favor?
Well, I think his relative silence was one way of adapting to that. You know, he I think once the dust settles after this law passed, he'll go back to advocating for Wall Street. And as you pointed out, he is responsible for bringing jobs to New York. So he is not someone who's going to want to punish Wall Street and see Wall Street broken up or broken down. He is going to still be an advocate for them. But, you know, I think it's going to be harder for him because I think he tainted his brand a little bit.
Well, has anybody confronted him on this?
Because
the press hasn't reported much on Senator Schumer's role in pushing deregulation in the financial industry.
Well, I mean, in fairness, there has been some attention to it, but you know, part of the virtue of raising as much money as he has, he has the single most money of any candidate running for a re-election in 2010, is that he scared off real opposition, and he has, I think it's safe to say, really token opposition. Any Republicans who are thinking of running for the Senate are more likely going to be running against Kirsten Gillibrand rather than Chuck Schumer. So he has not had an opponent really with the ability to force him to deal with these issues.
Well, it is interesting that I saw an ad run by some Republican support group that showed Chuck Schumer as the recipient of millions and millions of dollars from Wall Street as an argument against voting for Democrats, suggesting that the Democrats are in the pocket of Wall Street.
Right. That's another reason you haven't heard Schumer attack too much on these grounds, is particularly by Republicans. Since it was Republicans, it was the Bush administration that really engaged in deregulation, lack of regulation of the finance industry. I mean, it is important to remember Chuck Schumer was a senator, albeit an outspoken one, from the opposition party throughout the Bush administration. So it's not exactly – he was not exactly running the country when it came to financial regulation.
You mentioned that he's amassed this huge war chest. Why does he need to if he has pretty much no opposition?
Lenny, this just shows why you're not a politician. if you can,
I work in
why
public
not?
Radio. If I knew how to handle money, I'd be somewhere else.
Right. No, I mean, he's scared off his opposition. He's gotten the money has done its work and he hasn't had to spend a dime of it. And also keep in mind that as we get closer to the election, he may be in a position to support other Democratic candidates, which could help him if he's going to be running for majority leader as well.
Well, is that what made him successful as the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee head in two election cycles?
It was a big factor, but it wasn't the only factor. I mean, it's really an enormous political achievement that perhaps Schumer doesn't get enough credit for.
Well, how did he use the DSCC's resources differently than his predecessors had?
Well,
because he had real success.
He had great success. I mean,
that's why the Democrats have a majority to
right.
some degree.
When he took over the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, there were 45 Democratic senators, and when he left, there were 60. Now, they weren't all due to him, but he certainly played a role. And what he did was, first of all, he raised a tremendous amount of money, a lot of it from Wall Street. Again, that doesn't look as appealing now as it did when times were good. But the other thing was he took a greater hand in selecting candidates and doling out that money.
Now, one of the problems some people say the Democrats have is that many of the Democrats who ran were very conservative. They haven't really supported the president on every issue. And right now, they're very vulnerable in this next election cycle.
Well, I think that's not entirely fair. I mean, if you look at the senators who were elected under Schumer, first of all, none of them are up for re-election yet because it's only been 4 or 2 years since they were elected. And yes, it's true that a Mark Warner from Virginia, a Jim Webb from Virginia – John Tester from Montana is not going to be as liberal as a Sherrod Brown from Ohio or an Al Franken in Minnesota. But Democrats certainly stick together more often than they don't. And if you look at how polarized the Senate is, very much along party lines, it really does matter that they're Democrats there and not Republicans, even if they are more conservative Democrats than many liberals would like.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, whose latest article for The New Yorker is The Senator in the Street. It appears in the August 2nd issue of the magazine, the one that's on the newsstands right now. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Jeffrey Toobin, who writes about legal matters and politics. The New Yorker also is a senior analyst for CNN. And his article, The Senator and the Street, appears in the August 2nd issue of The New Yorker. And you write about a jobs proposal that Senator Schumer worked on with Utah's Senator Orrin Hatch. What kind of bill was that?
Well, it was a bill that it was supposed to be a jobs bill. And it is a jobs bill of sorts. And it basically gave employers a certain amount of credit, something off. They had to pay less taxes if they hired someone who had been unemployed for some time. It was a gesture to try to get employers to hire more.
Is this something that would appeal to Republicans?
Well, it was a tax cut. So, yes. So it did actually wind up passing the Senate with, I believe, 70 votes, but certainly well more than it needed. It was also a very modest bill. And you know, one contrast I tried to draw in the piece was Schumer's embrace of this very modest jobs bill and his real reluctance and discouragement of President Obama going forward with health care reform, which was anything but modest. And I thought it really showed his mindset, that he is someone who wants to focus on jobs, but in a very measured way, rather than to swing for the fences.
And that's was it simply a matter of the health care reform being too ambitious, or did he have some philosophical problems with it?
I don't think it was philosophical so much as political. I mean,
it's hard to be bipartisan these days. Is he still believing that the Senate can really work in a bipartisan way?
You know, I think he has – I mean, sure, he faces reality. I mean, he knows that basically everything is filibustered. Everything is subject to a 60-vote requirement. I think he is someone who really does believe in negotiation and really does believe in deal-making. You know, it was very important to him to make a deal with Orrin Hatch on these tax writing bills. I mean, someone that Schumer looks up to a lot or looked up to a lot was Ted Kennedy, who had a great history of working across party lines as well as being a liberal hero. And I think that's someone that as his Senate career continues, he's going to try to model himself on. The question I have is whether the deal making will trump the liberal values, because he certainly is known at the moment more for the former than the latter.
Who are the Baileys and how do they help Schumer decide on policies to propose or to support?
This is something that I found really almost endearing in its weirdness.
Because I'd never heard of them.
Yeah. When Schumer started running for office, when he ran for the state assembly in the 70s, before he ran for Congress in 1980, he came up with an imaginary middle-class family who originally were named the O'Reillys, but he decided to change it because he wanted a less ethnic name and he didn't want any association with Bill O'Reilly. So he changed it to the Baileys. And they live in Massapequa on Long Island. And basically, Schumer, he really does this. He thinks to himself when he's doing one of his Sunday press conferences or one of his political initiatives, it's like, how would the Baileys look at this? How would this sort of middle-class family look at this proposal?
So he thought the Baileys would not really want to see health care legislation?
That's right, because as he said to me about health care, most Americans, if they were not happy with their health care, they were not unhappy with it. These were insured. 75% of people have health insurance, and
And no, complain about it.
They complain about it. But look, I'm not defending what Schumer's saying. I'm just telling you what he said. And I was surprised at how reluctant he was to embrace one of these core liberal values, something that's been an agenda item for Democrats since Harry Truman.
And then he did vote for it. And on top of that, he helped get Nebraska Senator Ben Nelson, who is a very conservative Democrat, to vote for the bill too.
And you know, Schumer is nothing if not a loyal party guy. And once Obama said to him and others, look, this is what I'm betting my presidency on. I want this to succeed. Schumer worked very hard to get health care reform passed. It was just in a question of how do you set your agenda? What are your priorities? That's what the disagreement was. But he certainly pushed for it once it
How do his colleagues see him? You mentioned earlier the Bob Dole quip that the most dangerous place in Washington was between Chuck Schumer and a TV camera. Do most of his colleagues see him as a guy who really just wants to get a lot of media attention?
It's interesting. I spoke to a lot of senators about him, and I came to understand – I came to become familiar with the sort of look that senators got on their faces when you'd ask about Chuck Schumer. They'd sort of give kind of a rueful smile because they recognize that there is a kind of desperation and a hunger in him that is even greater than most – politicians. And look, you don't get there by being a shrinking violet, any of the hundred. But the other thing that I think is different from the old Chuck Schumer, the one that Bob Dole mocked, is that, you know, he has now a long record of success in that body, whether it's political success at the DSCC or legislative success in getting bills passed. This guy is a player. I mean, in any group of 100 people, There are passengers and there are drivers. And Chuck Schumer is clearly a driver in the Senate, a very important figure there. And I think, you know, his colleagues on either side can't help but respect that.
Is there a certain amount of loyalty toward Schumer among the senators who he helped when he was the head of the DSCC?
Certainly they are all unanimously very grateful to him. They really know how hard he worked to raise money for them, how much he was personally invested in their campaigns. Whether that means they will, as a group, vote for him for majority leader should the position become vacant, I can't say for sure. You know, party leader races are famously based on weird personal alliances that don't have a lot to do necessarily with political views. But most people in Washington seem to believe that if the contest came down to Durbin versus Schumer for majority leader, most people I talked to thought Schumer would win.
Although Schumer is also a Jewish senator from New York, and knowing what I know about the way politics plays out in this country, that might be a liability no matter what other people think of him.
Especially when the leader in the House is Nancy Pelosi, mm-hmm. who is also noticeably ethnic, noticeably urban, from San Francisco. So one of the arguments –
As
an arch liberal. I think with more justification, frankly, than for Schumer. And that's a factor, and that might hurt Schumer in his race for majority leader. I think, however, if there is a race, all Democrats in this environment know there's only one Democrat who's really the leader of this party, and it's not Chuck Schumer. It's not Nancy Pelosi. It's Barack Obama. So I don't think he would be seen as that much of a symbol of the party, and it would be much more about who could get stuff done in the Senate.
Although he'd be a lot less laid back than Harry Reid in that – might be seen as a positive thing.
That might be. Again, it's very hard to handicap these Senate races because they go so much based on personalities and personal grievances. So, you know, he would be very different from Harry Reid. Harry Reid is a laconic former boxer from Nevada. Chuck Schumer is an outspoken New Yorker. The personalities are very different.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin of The New Yorker, also a senior analyst for CNN. His article, The Senator in the Street, appears in the August 2nd issue of The New Yorker. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Can we talk about some other things? Because you write a lot about the court. In last Sunday's New York Times, Adam Liptak wrote about how the decisions of the Roberts Court have been to the right of the Rehnquist Court. And they are the most. This is the most conservative court that we've had since before Roosevelt?
Since the early Roosevelt years? Four horsemen who stopped the New Deal. I think that's right.
Is this a revelation?
I don't think it's a revelation to those of us who follow the court closely. I thought what made the story so good is that there was an element of political science data to support this impression we have. Now, it's hard to assign every Supreme Court opinion to a liberal or conservative category, but I don't have any doubt that the conclusions of that story were accurate. And you know, I did a profile earlier this year of John Paul Stevens before he retired, and he said something that I'll always remember. He said, you know, since I came to the court in 1975, every justice who's left, with possibly one exception, every justice who's left has been replaced by someone more conservative.
That includes the Democrats.
That includes the Democrats. And look who's been president. You know, the Republicans have made most of the appointments to the Supreme Court. Now, it's not even – it's pretty close to evenly divided. I think the four Democratic appointees, you know, once Kagan is confirmed, as she certainly will be in the next couple of weeks, Kagan, Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Breyer, they're not conservative justices, but they don't have the votes. You know, Anthony Kennedy joins them now and then, but you have rarely seen in the last century four justices together as conservative as Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia.
Sandra Day O'Connor was the previous swing vote, and she was a lot more liberal than Anthony Kennedy is. He can generally be assumed to want to vote with the conservative majority.
Yes, but Kennedy will certainly side with the liberals now and then. I mean, it's important to remember that Anthony Kennedy was the author of some of the Guantanamo Bay decisions against the Bush administration. He wrote Lawrence v. Texas, which was the most important gay rights decision ever issued by the Supreme Court. So I really do think it's worth drawing that distinction. But certainly you're right in general that a swing vote of Anthony Kennedy versus a swing vote of Sandra O'Connor will certainly produce more conservative decisions.
Now, what about the fight that we see every time somebody is named to the court? There used to be a time when it was assumed that if the president named a justice to the court, that was what he wanted, and there might be some opposition, but not a lot. We've seen a lot of polarization, although Democrats voted for Samuel Alito, and it was apparent, and for Roberts, it was apparent that both of them were extremely conservative.
Some did. Alito didn't get 70 votes. I mean, there were a lot of Democrats opposed to him. But, you know, things have changed. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, clearly a liberal. When she was nominated in 1993 by President Clinton, she got more than 90 votes. Stephen Breyer, the next year, got more than 90 votes. This is a manifestation of the polarization that we're living through. And frankly, I don't have much of a complaint about it because I think these Supreme Court justices are as much politicians as anyone else. And why should a Republican senator vote for a Democratic nominee who's going to vote to preserve abortion rights? I mean, these are important matters, and I don't see why senators shouldn't vote on them on ideological grounds.
And the swing in this case might be Maine Senator Olympia Snowe, who announced that she's going to vote for Kagan.
Yeah, Kagan is not in any trouble. I mean, there have been no announced plans for a filibuster. There have been no Democratic defections. So with 59 Democrats and with Snowe, Richard Lugar's voting for her, she's clearly going to be confirmed. There's no problem for
her. Well, it wouldn't change the balance of the court, as you said. And also the conservative majority, all of those judges are rather young.
Well,
so,
not so much. Actually, Scalia is 75 years old. Kennedy is 74 years old. You know, that's not old for a Supreme Court justice, but that's, you know, if Barack Obama gets reelected, I would anticipate that not only would he have appointments to the court, but he would have the opportunity to change the balance in the court. I don't think Scalia and Kennedy and Thomas are going to be there as long as John Paul Stevens was, who served till he was 90.
none of the four Republicans who are supporting Kagan are up for re-election. I don't know whether that's significant.
That I think that is significant. They are not. This is a very look at what happened to Bob Bennett in Utah. Orrin Hatch is someone who's dealt with Elena Kagan a lot when she worked at the White House, when she was Solicitor General nominee. I think in another environment, Orrin Hatch would have voted to confirm Elena Kagan. But he saw what happened to Bob Bennett for collaborating with Democrats, and he decided not to take the chance.
And people are saying that Lindsey Graham will face a primary challenge in part because he says he's going to vote for the Kagan nomination.
Lindsey Graham is in the fortunate position of having just been reelected in 2010, so we'll see how long people remember this when he's up for reelection in 2016.
Well, he is from South Carolina, which has some of the strangest candidates running this year.
Well, and one of the most conservative Republican parties of any state. So, yes, it is something of a risk for him to vote for Kagan.
What do you think about the injunction, the preliminary injunction against the Arizona immigration enforcement law that was supposed to go into effect today?
I think that was a very hard case, particularly the way the Obama administration brought it, because so much of the attention to the Arizona law was focused on the issue of racial profiling, violation of Hispanic Americans' rights. And the Obama administration, perhaps characteristically, sidestepped that controversy and instead focused on the issue of federal power versus state power and said that the attempts to force police to check on the immigration status of everyone they stop who is reasonably suspected of being an illegal immigrant, a very bizarre and vague standard, they argued that that was a violation of the federal government's rights. And that, I think, I don't think it's the world's most compelling argument, but it was one that the judge agreed with and may well be upheld.
Well, if it winds up before the Supreme Court, the argument is bound to center around the 10th Amendment, isn't it?
Well, that's one of the issues. There's also the Supremacy Clause in Article 6, which says that federal law is the supreme law of the land. I have to believe this is a case that will wind up before the Supreme Court because it does deal with really very important structural issues about what's a state power, what's a federal power, this controversy looks like it's going to be replicated in other states around the country. So I think this is why we have a Supreme Court, and I don't think they'll want to duck this one.
Well, the you don't think the Obama administration was right in saying immigration policy is the right of the federal government?
I'm less sure of that. When I was an assistant U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, we worked very cooperatively with the police department. The line between federal and state authority when it comes to immigration is not the most visible in the law. I mean, it is certainly true that Arizona would not have the right under the Constitution to declare war on Mexico, but immigration, it's a harder call.
Jeffrey Toobin's article, The Senator in the Street, appears in the August 2nd issue of The New Yorker. You can also see him regularly on CNN, where he is a senior analyst. And it's always a pleasure to have him visit our show. Thank you so much for being here again,
Jeffrey. Great to be back.